Friday afternoons on CKUW 95.9 FM are brought to you by Half Pints Brewing Company, Winnipeg's only local brewery. Think local, drink local. Half Pints.
Hello, we are back, and that was just some of the audio from what was happening at Occupy Winnipeg today with the incident of the tent burning down. There will be more on that on Monday morning on People of Interest, 8 to 9 a.m., so tune in for that if you want a little bit more. But also on the same subject of Occupy, I have a couple people here joining me in the studio, Alex Patterson, Terry Weymouth, and Alex Garcia. And they're all involved in this, in one way or another, in this document that was drafted a little while ago called Decolonize and Reoccupy Winnipeg. And this was passed by the Occupy Winnipeg General Assembly on November 6th, 2011. So I guess maybe I'll start with you, Alex Patterson. Explain the document and why it was drafted, please.
So there's been about 400 years of colonization in North America, and right from the get-go, you've had indigenous people resisting it. And then in the last few, I would say like since the 1960s, it's been a different type of resistance where it's been more of an ideological resistance and a talking back against oppression. And the way that I originally posed the document to the people at Occupy was that non-Indigenous people need to start responding to the call for rights and to take our responsibilities from treaties and act appropriately in the world. And to do that, the non-Indigenous people, in concert with the Indigenous people, do need to talk about what our responsibilities are. So the document outlines how the policies and the actions that non-Indigenous people can take to stop intervening in Indigenous politics.
That's a very interesting, and as I pointed out at the start of the show, I mean, it's an interesting document, and it's not too much to my surprise that you didn't get to hear much about it in the mainstream media, of course. But Terry, you are an Indigenous person, a Canadian Indigenous person, correct?
Yes, I am.
So now, there is somewhat of a knowledge of the history of colonization in Canada. You know, you saw the apology for the residential school system. So there seems to be at least a bit of a shallow knowledge, but it still is in very ways very hidden from a lot of mainstream Canadians and mainstream Canada. So could you talk a bit about that and related to this document and what you're trying to do? Is it sort of like an educational sort of thing? It's to try to call attention to this?
Of course it is. Actually, it starts at school and the lack of introduction into the curriculums at school. Like when I went to high school, the ministry requirement was 25 years over a five-year period of Aboriginal history and culture. That's very minimal. That's barely enough to even like absorb. Mm-hmm. So it starts at the school process. Like there's a lack of attention when it comes to educating students about history and culture. So that's what we're trying to do now. We're trying to educate people and unlearn people about what they already know.
Now, what do you mean by unlearn what they already know?
Well, obviously, everybody has their own stigmas and stereotypes about what Aboriginal people are, where they come from. So they need to unlearn that. So that's what we're doing with this statement, is that we're telling them what our concerns are, where we come from, and what we want to see happen.
So could you talk a bit about, I have the document here. When you're talking about cultural survival, economic justice, self-determination, I mean, maybe take a talk about cultural survival and how the role is with education. I mean, you as an Indigenous person, I mean, it seemed obvious to me that you have come across this sort of thing on a day-to-day basis, even going through the educational system, right? I mean,
yes.
So could you talk a bit about that experience as an Indigenous person?
I was adopted, and I was raised as most people were, like a typical education. And there was a lack of cultural education. I had to take the initiative to do that myself. But post-secondary institutions across Canada are starting to do that, implemented Indigenous programs and First Nations programs, focusing on language and culture and history and heritage. And there needs to be more of that in school so that people can become aware and educate themselves.
So also in terms of economic justice, because it is something that comes... comes up a little bit more in the media when they talk about Aboriginal land claims and how it, Indigenous land claims, and how it affects whether or not they can do resource extraction. Can you talk to that at all and sort of that sort of, those sort of actions?
Yeah, of course. Post-colonization, the people were very reliant on a government funding. Most reserves still are, so they rely on that funding. So they're getting to the stage now where they're becoming self-reliant in terms of creating their own economy through resource sharing, additional sources of revenue such as land developments, like these land claims, for example. It's not the same across Canada. Every territory has their own way of dealing with the government. Like, for example, in BC, there's not a treaty system set up there. It's like unceded land territory. So they still have the same land that they always had. So it all depends on a province-to-province basis.
And I'll get to Alex Garcia in a second here. But, Terry, I also wonder... Because I've covered the issue before about specifically with the tar sands and some of this pipeline development, where Indigenous land claims have actually stopped some pipeline development. And it was actually in a WikiLeaks where some oil companies said that, in no uncertain terms, that they don't want to develop some of these pipelines because Indigenous land claims scare the heck out of them. Is that sort of a how do I put this? How do I put this question now? So it is I'm kind of losing my thought
okay,
here.
Is that sort of showing
that you guys do have some sort of power then?
Of course. Let me clarify that for you. The last estimate that the federal government took on to settle every land claim that's brought up to the forefront right now would take 150 years.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's probably why these companies are afraid, because it's a lengthy process.
Mm-hmm.
So that could actually stop their development or, like, cease.
Alex, you are an Indigenous person, but you're from South America, right?
It's really hard for me to say that I'm an Indigenous person.
Okay.
The vast majority of Central... I'm from Central America.
Central, sorry.
I'm from El Salvador. The vast majority of Central America is now what is called mestizo, which means that after about 500 years ago, the Spanish came, there was a great eradication of the existing leftover, like the remnants of the Maya empires, the remnants of the Aztec empires, and other different indigenous, I guess, cultures. But because of all the intermarriage, the rape that happened, murder and cultural genocide in El Salvador, the language that used to be spoken was called Pipil. It's a Nahua language. Nahua is what the Aztecs spoke, what the Mayans spoke. It's this kind of family of dialects. But about 25 years ago, there was this dictionary that was made of it. I've got a copy of it, and it's really awesome. But when it was made, there were about 200 speakers left in El Salvador. If you go to neighboring Guatemala, they still speak a lot of Quechua. But so and because my family comes from all over the place, because people just migrate from here and there, I don't actually know my whole background. But if you looked at my grandfather on my mom's side, he looked very indigenous. You can tell different facial features, different body types, who is more from this side of the world than who is more from Europe. So I would, like, I know that I have blood in me that stays on this continent for a long time, but I don't know how much of it is.
Now, in terms of the Occupy movement, and you're talking about the relation in Central America, do you think this is something that could be fruitful for the struggles that people in Central America have already been going through in terms of solidarity with the Occupy movement, or the Occupy movement having solidarity with those sorts of struggles in Central America? Do you think that that could be something that could be fruitful? Or
I think it really depends on how radical the Occupy movement becomes, like if it really starts to address root causes of structural inequalities, because you can't stay within North America if you're going to talk, like if this whole rhetoric of the 99% versus the 1% is to be taken truthfully and not just at face value, then it has to begin to address first the 99th percentile, which is all people of color on this planet, all people that have been colonized, all people that continue to live under, I guess, the neo-colonization or the neo-imperialism of global capitalism. Until those needs become addressed, this movement is just it's for the reestablishment of a middle class. So if Occupy succeeds in you know, creating greater equality, it can't just create equality in the United States and Canada. It has to create equality across the board. So to answer your question, yes.
Yeah. Alex Patterson, you wanted to say something.
I think there's also something important to note, that Canadian corporations don't just exploit the Indigenous and Euro-Canadian citizens and the migrants here in Canada, but there's Indigenous mining corporations doing really nasty things to the environment and the peoples in Central and South America, in Peru, like Barrick Gold in Chile. There's stuff in Bolivia and a whole bunch of other countries that, like, it's hard to list all the places that Canadian corporations are being greedy and hurting people. So there's links and alliances and solidarity that needs to be made between all the peoples experiencing that from the Canadian corporations that we're fighting here in the Occupy movement.
Yeah. Now, I wouldn't mind getting all three of you to respond to this. And Alex Garcia, you made a good point, and I'm glad you raised it about, you know, thinking about the 99% globally, and that how, in a lot of ways, maybe a lot of the people in Occupy are maybe closer to that 1% than they are the 99% globally. So is it something that might be a little too much for some of these people involved in Occupy to try to grasp with or come to terms with themselves? Do you think?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of like Occupy Wall Street starts at addressing an economic disaster that affects people that hadn't been affected before 2008. It didn't start out, and you know, like, yes, I suppose you do need an impetus to start these social movements, but it never organically addressed the fact that people of color in the United States have been forced out of their homes, have been denied access to jobs, suffer way worse police brutality than anybody at Occupy has suffered. It didn't talk about this. It talked about the issues that affected largely white middle class men. And I think that that's bled into a lot of the different Occupies. So this whole decolonization process is difficult, I think, to grasp from a point of, or a perspective of privilege. And it, you know, it spans across a lot of the occupiers.
Terry.
Yes.
So, in talk, you, like, same question I gave to to Alex Garcia. Is it sort of, like we said, this Occupy movement seems in a lot of ways concerned with more the middle-class white people's problems rather than Indigenous people or Aboriginal people in Canada. So do you think there's enough maturity in the Occupy movement to kind of realize their stance as part of this, the Canadian state and colonization and their role in it?
Of course, it affects everybody. Actually, what I've observed since my participation in this movement is that it's inspired other people with various concerns and issues to stand up and speak up for what they believe in. And to answer your question before about people that may not have a grasp for this because they may be potentially part of the 1%, it's actually good that they are getting involved and learning about this because maybe they're changing their ways. Maybe they're starting to realize that they are part of something that's wrong. They're part of the problem, so they're becoming part of the solution. So I think it's actually a good thing.
Alex Patterson, do you want to talk a bit about that? About this is sort of the hurdle there that to kind of understand, like this Occupy movement in North America, understand its why their own role in subjugating people in the South.
Yeah. I think that a lot of the calls for what basically became the dream of the welfare state after the world wars was a lot about taking wealth from the South, and people need to start trying to figure out in the Occupy movements what it means to actually give up our economic privilege and what the highest common denominator of luxury and material wealth is in the world. Like, what is the highest amount of luxury that can be supported ecologically for all people across the world? And what is, like, how do we have to share that wealth so that everyone is living the equal, sustainable life? So maybe the Occupy movement needs to stop talking about what our economic rights are and what we feel entitled to, and start talking about what our responsibilities to other individuals are as communities, what our responsibility is to the ecology, and what our responsibility is to other communities. And I think Danny Glover on the 15th of October gave a really awesome speech in Oakland where he said, this is about transforming our humanity. And it's not just about the system. It's not just about the 1% that we identify in Canada. It's about all of us getting together and fighting for a world that's equal for everyone. It's been the dream for most peoples that have not experienced equality has always been the fight for a better world.
Alex, I wouldn't mind even getting, because I asked about this sort of this gap between people's perceptions and how they view Indigenous and Aboriginal people. And I mean, you drafted this and you're a non-Indigenous person. So could you talk about sort of your own thinking and how you kind of transverse that gap in your own thinking and to draft this document saying in solidarity with other Indigenous struggles?
I guess the process is that for the last 5 years in my activism in school and in my life travels, I've been kind of like listening to what Indigenous people have been saying. And I thought it was time for non-Indigenous people to get together and be like, we heard you. We get it. We're on your side. And we want to mobilize other non-Indigenous people to do that too. Because I think that it's really unfair for all of the responsibility of decolonization to be put on the backs of the brown people and Indigenous people of the world. So there's got to be some non-Indigenous people. Like, I don't actually identify as white per se. I'm actually mixed. So it's still a half brown person taking responsibility for organizing the whites. But there's got to be that time when the non-Indigenous people step up and we say, this is what justice looks like. We get it. And take some of the burden off of the Indigenous people and be like, we're fighting together for common goals across the world. And it's not just your fight. You can lead it. You can tell us what you want. And we'll try and figure out a world together that makes what we need happen together.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to just take a quick break and then we'll be right back. So do stay tuned. This is Warning Shots on CKUW 95.9 FM. Yes, and we are back here on CKUW 95.9 FM. This is Warning Shots, CKUW's independent international news show. And right now I'm still joined with Alex Patterson and Terry Weymouth talking about the Occupy movement and its how possible relations to indigenous struggles. Now, we've had a, I guess it's been a, about over a month now of this Occupy movement. What do you guys think are so far been the strengths and sort of the weaknesses of it so far? Terry, maybe you want to take that first.
From my impressions, the strengths have been the diversity of people, that there's people from all different backgrounds, all walks of life, such as the world goes. We need, everybody has their own strengths and their own skills to bring to the table. So I like the collective diversity that's there. The weaknesses is, on the same token, the diversity and like the fact that everybody's from like from different backgrounds, that everybody has their own idea and their own passions of where they want to see this go. So sometimes it's kind of hard to come to a general consensus, but overall, it's been a very unifying experience.
Now, it's interesting that you say that in your experience, there's a lot of diversity, because again, mainstream media will say it's just a bunch of white hipster people.
Okay,
so I mean, so the. Talk to that.
Yeah, let me clarify that. I mean, like, there's people from all over, from different cultural backgrounds. For example, one of our structures that are down there was brought down by the 12 tribes. They're a Christian-based community. They came down and they built a semi-permanent structure down there for us. There's people that have come from different faiths to come and visit us. Like, I'm Aboriginal, but there's people that have different academic, sociological, and economic backgrounds. So it's not like what one would portray in the media. It's not just the one like specific group of people.
Mm-hmm. Alex,
I do think that there's been an unfortunate lack of other people of color, though. Like straight up, like we're good, and I mean, there's not that many out queer or trans people as well. Actually, I think 90% of the people of color in Occupy were in this room for the interview when Alex Garcia was here with us. So it's problematic in that sense, but there are lots of people at Occupy who are down and get what is being brought in terms of racial critiques of capitalism and things like that. What needs to happen is that we need to focus on just straight up outreach to the areas and communities that are most affected by capitalism. I think people were coming to common goals, we're coming to all these things, but to implement them in a way where the most affected by capitalism of the 99% have ownership over it, we need to make a concerted effort to reach out to indigenous people and migrant communities to both bring them in, so that it is like a real movement of those types of people, because indigenous people experience the third world conditions here in North America, and then it's the migrants that's families are experiencing that in the global south.
Right. Now, but with that kind of outreach, and we talked about how there's so much diversity within the Occupy movement. I mean, how does that outreach begin to happen? Is it just like some, like, because it is a leaderless thing? Does it just like someone just has to pull the reins and, you know, put the boot to people's butts and say, come on, let's go?
Can I respond to that? I think issues such as like social injustice, poverty, and homelessness, it doesn't discriminate. So it affects everybody. It affects people's families, friends. So I think it's just natural that we come together to try to like form ideas of how we can address these issues and do something about it.
Mm-hmm. But again, the you're talking about some of the problematic things with race at Occupy and how some of the people of color aren't being represented. And with a diversity of views, I'm just saying, like, do you need someone to, like I said, like, because Occupy is a leaderless thing. Is it needing someone to come in and just say, to really spearhead it? Not necessarily be a leader, but to someone to just, like I said, just pull the reins and say, let's go and reach out to the migrant workers in Manitoba and that kind of stuff. Yeah.
I think that one of the issues is that maybe we, like the three of us who have been in here, have spent too much time trying to convince the other folks to come along with us and do it. And maybe it's time that we just do it. There are some down, like, people that will probably come along if we start doing it. But it's, I think part of it has been that we want to see this recognition in action from the non-Indigenous folks, especially, that they need to get over whatever discomfort and weird privilege things they have going on and actually reach out to Indigenous people and say, we want you here because you have something to offer. One of the things that happens too much is Indigenous people are just brought in for their spiritual knowledge, but I want to see non-Indigenous people be like, I want you here because we need to band together against the 1%, like, irrespective of these, like, mystified parts of Aboriginal culture. Or there's this another dynamic where there's actually an appropriation of non-Indigenous people of Indigenous struggles. Instead of fighting their own, they just support Indigenous struggles. But no, we need to see Indigenous struggles as part of our common struggle for social justice, and they be brought in as an equal participant and an equal leader in a vast movement where their concerns are going to be a part of it.
Now, we've seen some state backlash to the Occupy movement more overtly in the United States and a little differently in Canada, with them trying to just move the occupiers out. Do you think those sorts of actions now have sort of more or less just galvanize people to just stand their ground but not reach out necessarily, that now it's more of them just on the defensive, and how that, you know, Terry?
Actually, I think on the contrary, it's actually strengthened the ones that are still getting the less resistance in other areas. It's strengthened those Occupy movements so that other people are, like, just even being more aggressive and more proactive in their actions and speaking up for themselves. So if anything, it's strengthened what people, like, the people that are continuing with this movement.
Alex?
I mean, almost right from day one, I kind of had this understanding in my mind that any protest doesn't last forever, no matter what form it takes. So that one of the things that I've really wanted to do is create permanent alliances between people that meet there and activists. So, like, even if the occupation ends, they can't evict the occupation in the spirit of rebellion from our hearts and from the way we relate to each other. So just this week, myself and 15 other students, and we have some people that are, like, another, like, 15 people who are also down in it, have started a student revolutionary federation of the different campuses in Winnipeg. And our idea is also to acknowledge that not all youth get to go to university. It's a very privileged thing. So one of our main jobs is going to be making connections between youth in the university and youth who never get to go to the colleges or universities, so that we're creating a youth movement as well. Because in all successful revolutions, it's been the youth that have been the driving radical force, because it's the youth that inherit the earth.
Great. Well, I think I'm going to leave it there. Thank you, Alex and Terry, for coming on and talking about these this very important issue, and something, like I said, is something that's been there and I've read about more internally with the Occupy movement, but something that doesn't get much mainstream coverage. It's more, oh, what are these people doing? We have no idea. So thank you very much for coming on and explaining some of these things. Thank you very much, guys. And now we're just going to go for another quick musical break. We'll be right back. Yes, and that was our episode, Warning Shots, for November 25th, 2011. So we heard at the top of the show an update on Occupy Winnipeg from CKW News Director Michael Welsh about the tent burning down. And then we had a discussion between Alex Patterson, Alex Garcia, and Terry Weymouth about the decolonize and reoccupy document that was drafted on November 16th from the Occupy movement, and kind of talking about Occupy, but in the context of the global 99%, and how Occupy could start to, or this notion of in solidarity with indigenous struggles around the world. So I was your host, Scott Price. If there is any questions, comments, or concerns, do phone us, 786-9782. You can also contact our news director, Michael Welsh. His email is ckewnews@rocketmail.com. Also, check me out on Twitter. If you just look up Warning Shots, you will find me, and you can follow up on some of the updates and other little tidbits and things I throw out there. So I thank you for tuning in and supporting alternative independent media.